A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the American dream, not as a slogan, but as something you can actually measure. When people say upward social mobility is collapsing, what specifically are they measuring? How do economists define it? And what does the opposite look like? Not in theory, but in someone's actual life. There's a lot of unpacking to do here, because most of the public conversation skips straight past the definitions and into the feelings.
The definitions are where everything interesting lies. Let me start with a number that should frame this whole conversation. A child born in 1940 had a 90% chance of out-earning their parents by age 30. A child born in 1980 has a 50% chance. That's a coin flip. That's from Raj Chetty and his team at Opportunity Insights. They published this in 2017 in a paper called The Fading American Dream, and it's become the empirical anchor for this entire field.
90 to 50. That's not a decline. That's a collapse wearing a decline's clothing.
It really is. And here's what makes it more striking. This isn't about GDP growth slowing. The economy grew over that period. The pie got bigger. The problem is how the pie got sliced. So before we go further, we need to make a distinction that almost nobody in public discourse makes, but it's essential. There are actually two completely different things people mean when they say social mobility: absolute mobility and relative mobility.
All right, define them.
Absolute mobility is the straightforward one. Are you better off than your parents in real dollar terms? Did you earn more at age 30 than they did at age 30, adjusted for inflation? That's the version of the American dream people actually mean when they say, "I want my kids to have a better life." Relative mobility is completely different. It's about your rank in the income distribution. If your parents were at the 30th percentile, are you also at the 30th percentile? Or did you move to the 50th or the 80th? It's not about whether you have more money, it's about whether your position in the pecking order changed.
Absolute mobility is a bigger house. Relative mobility is a different zip code.
And here's the thing that messes with people's heads. These two measures can move in opposite directions. You can have a situation where everyone's incomes are rising, so absolute mobility looks great, but relative mobility is zero because nobody changed rank. Or you can have a recession where everyone gets poorer, so absolute mobility tanks, but relative mobility spikes because the distribution scrambles.
Which means when someone on cable news says social mobility is dead, they're usually talking about absolute mobility without knowing that's what they're talking about.
And the Chetty data is specifically about absolute mobility. They linked de-identified tax records across parents and children, millions of records, and compared what the parents earned when the child was around 16 to what that child earned at age 30. They controlled for inflation using the CPI URS, which is a more accurate inflation measure than the standard CPI, and they did it cohort by cohort, so you can watch the decline happen year by year.
Walk me through the cohorts. What does the curve actually look like?
For children born in 1940, as I said, about 90% out-earned their parents. For the 1950 cohort, it was around 80%. 1960, around 62%. 1970, 61%. 1980, 50%. And for children born in 1985, it dropped further to roughly 47%. So it's not a sudden cliff. It's a steady erosion over four decades, with the steepest drops happening in the 70s and 80s.
If you were born in 1985, you had a worse than coin flip chance of doing better than your parents.
Worse than a coin flip. And that cohort is now 40 years old, so we're talking about people in their prime earning years right now. This isn't a projection, it's a rearview mirror.
The obvious follow-up is why. If the economy grew, why didn't the tide lift the boats?
Because the growth went overwhelmingly to the top of the distribution. Chetty's team ran a counterfactual simulation. They asked, what would absolute mobility look like if we had the same GDP growth we actually experienced, but distributed it the way we distributed growth in the 1940s and 50s? The answer, Absolute mobility would be around 80% for the 1980 cohort, not 50%, so about two-thirds of the decline in absolute mobility is explained by the distribution of growth becoming more unequal. Only about one-third is explained by slower overall GDP growth.
It's not that the ladder got shorter, it's that the rungs got spaced further apart.
That's a perfect way to put it. And that brings us to something called the Great Gatsby Curve. This is one of the most important empirical findings in this field. Alan Krueger, who was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under Obama, gave a speech in 2012 where he plotted income inequality against intergenerational earnings elasticity across countries. Earnings elasticity is a measure of immobility. A higher number means your parents' income predicts your income more strongly.
A high elasticity means a rigid society. Low elasticity means fluid.
And what Krueger found is that countries with higher inequality also have higher immobility. They form this tight upward-sloping line. The United States is way out at the extreme, highest inequality among wealthy countries and highest immobility. The U.S. ranks 27th out of 30 OECD countries on intergenerational earnings elasticity. Only Italy, the U.K., and Chile rank lower.
27th out of 30. That's not a statistical blip. That's a structural feature.
It really is. And the mechanism is intuitive when you think about it. When the income distribution stretches out, when the distance between the 10th percentile and the 90th percentile gets wider, the distance a child born at the bottom has to travel to surpass their parents' rank gets physically larger. It's like trying to jump a wider and wider gap. Even if you run at the same speed, you're less likely to make it.
What does that gap look like in actual numbers? If I'm born in the bottom quintile, what are my actual odds?
In the United States, a child born into the bottom quintile, the bottom 20% of the income distribution, has about an 8% chance of reaching the top quintile as an adult. A child born into the top quintile has a 47% chance of staying there. Compare that to Denmark, bottom to top is about 12%. Top quintile persistence is about 36%. Canada, bottom to top is about 13%. Top persistence around 33%.
The American number for bottom-to-top mobility, 8%. That's not just bad relative to the mythology. It's bad relative to actual peer countries.
It's substantially worse, and the Great Gatsby Curve tells you why. The U.S. income distribution is more stretched out than Denmark's or Canada's, so the climb is simply longer. But there's more to it than just the distance. There are specific mechanisms that make the climb harder. This is what some researchers call opportunity hoarding.
Which sounds like a term designed to make people uncomfortable.
It should make people uncomfortable. It describes the specific, often invisible ways that high-income families transmit advantage to their children, and they're not doing anything illegal or even consciously strategic in most cases. They're just doing what affluent parents do, buying homes in neighborhoods with good public schools, paying for enrichment activities, leveraging social networks for internships and job placements.
The housing school linkage is the one that seems hardest to disentangle.
It's enormous. Public school funding in the U.S. is tied to local property taxes. So, if you can afford a house in a high property value district, your children attend a well-funded school. If you can't, they don't. And here's a concrete example that makes this vivid. A family earning $200,000 a year in San Francisco is paying an enormous portion of that income on housing, probably 40 to 50%, and sending their kids to schools that are good, but not exceptional by Bay Area standards. That same income in Omaha, Nebraska buys you a large house in the best school district in the state, with money left over for tutoring, music lessons, travel sports teams, and college savings. Same income, radically different opportunity sets for the children.
Geographic arbitrage is a hidden engine of mobility, or immobility, depending on whether you can access it.
And we'll come back to geography, because it turns out to be one of the most powerful levers in the entire mobility conversation. But first, let me give you a statistic that really brings home the opportunity hoarding point. Chetty's team looked at children from the bottom quintile who score in the top decile on standardized tests. These are genuinely high-ability kids from low-income backgrounds. They are still less likely to reach the top quintile as adults than children from the top quintile who score in the bottom decile on those same tests.
Say that again.
A low-income kid who tests in the top 10% nationally has worse odds of reaching the top income quintile than a high-income kid who tests in the bottom 10%.
talent is less predictive than birth.
In the United States, yes. That's what the data shows. The high-income, low-test-score kid has about a 27% chance of staying in the top quintile. The low-income, high-test-score kid has about a 22% chance of reaching it. It's not a massive gap, but the fact that it exists at all, that being born rich with low aptitude beats being born poor with high aptitude, that's the birth lottery in its starkest form.
That's a devastating sentence. I want to sit with it for a moment, but I also want to pivot to the other side of this coin. We've talked about what upward mobility looks like and why it's broken, but the prompt asks about the opposite. What does downward mobility actually look like in practice?
This is where we need to be careful with definitions too. Downward mobility isn't just the dramatic version, someone falling from the middle class into poverty or homelessness. That happens, and it's real, but it's not the main story. The main story is more subtle and more widespread. It's the structural inability to maintain your parents' standard of living despite equivalent or greater effort.
It's not falling off the ladder. It's climbing at the same speed but ending up lower because the ladder moved.
Let me give you a concrete example. A factory worker in Youngstown, Ohio in 1970 could support a family of four on a single income, own a home, take a vacation once a year, and save for retirement. Their grandchild, living in the same city today, faces a 15% unemployment rate, a housing stock that has depreciated in value, and a labor market where the good manufacturing jobs have been replaced by service sector work paying half the real wage. That grandchild is not destitute. They might be working two jobs. They might be renting. They might be getting by. But they are objectively worse off than their grandparent was at the same age, despite working more hours.
The grandparent wasn't a college graduate. They weren't a high-skilled knowledge worker. They were a factory worker who could build a middle-class life.
That path has largely closed. Let me give you some numbers on what's happened to the cost of middle-class life. Median household income has grown at about 0.3% annually since 1970 after inflation. That's basically flat. Meanwhile, the cost of key middle-class goods has exploded. Healthcare costs have risen about 200% after inflation since 1980. College tuition is up 169% after inflation. Housing. The median renter in 1960 spent 24% of their income on rent. By 2024, that number was 33%. For low-income renters, it's now over 50%.
The basket of goods that defines a middle-class life has gotten dramatically more expensive, while the income to buy that basket has barely budged.
That's the squeeze. It's not that people are making less money, median income is slightly up. It's that the things you need to be middle-class cost far more than they used to relative to what you earn.
Which brings us to the college question. The traditional escape hatch.
The college mobility premium. For decades, a bachelor's degree was a near guarantee of upward mobility. If you were the first in your family to go to college, you were almost certainly going to out-earn your parents. That's no longer reliably true. The college wage premium, the extra earnings a degree gets you over a high school diploma, has plateaued since around 2000, and the variance in outcomes by institution is enormous. A degree from a selective public university or a top private school still pays off handsomely. A degree from a for-profit college or a non-selective public university often leaves graduates with significant debt and earnings not much higher than if they hadn't attended at all.
College has shifted from being an engine of mobility to being a hedge against downward mobility, and a hedge that doesn't always pay off.
That's precisely the framing, and the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce has documented this extensively. Median wages for college graduates aged 25 to 34 have increased by only 14% since 1980 after inflation. Meanwhile, tuition has increased 169%. So the return on the investment has been compressed dramatically, even as the sticker price has exploded.
If you pick the wrong school or the wrong major, you can end up worse off than if you'd never gone.
Which is a sentence that would have been unthinkable in 1970. And it connects to another mechanism I want to talk about, the distinction between churning and stasis in the income distribution. A healthy, mobile society has high churn, people moving up and down the income ladder, fluidity, reshuffling. A rigid society has stasis, people staying in the same quintile as their parents. The U.S. has seen a decline in churn. People are more likely to remain in the same quintile as their parents than they were a generation ago.
Which is the relative mobility story, not the absolute mobility story.
Absolute mobility is about whether the whole distribution is shifting upward. Relative mobility is about whether you can change your position within it. And on the relative mobility front, the U.S. has never been particularly good compared to peer countries, but it's gotten worse. The probability that a child born in the bottom quintile stays in the bottom quintile as an adult has increased. The probability that a child born in the top quintile stays in the top quintile has also increased. The ends are stickier.
The rich stay rich and the poor stay poor, with greater reliability than they used to.
The middle gets hollowed out from both directions. Some people fall out of it downward, some people exit upward. But the net effect is a contraction of the middle class as a share of the population. That's what people mean when they talk about the middle class squeeze in structural terms.
Let's talk about geography as a mechanism. You mentioned it earlier. Americans moving less than they used to.
This is one of the most under-discussed structural changes in the American economy. The interstate migration rate, the percentage of Americans who move across state lines in a given year, was 6.9% in 1980. In 2024, it was 3.4%. It's been cut in half. Housing costs in high-opportunity metro areas have become prohibitive. It's hard to move to Seattle or Boston or San Francisco for a better job if you can't afford to live there. Occupational licensing has expanded dramatically. Something like 25% of workers now need a state-specific license to do their job, which makes moving across state lines more complicated. Dual-income households make moving harder because both partners need to find new jobs. And there's some evidence that social networks have become more localized. People are less willing to move away from family and community.
The consequence is that people get trapped in low-opportunity areas.
Labor market matching efficiency declines. You have a worker in a declining region with skills that could be valuable in a growing region, but they can't get to the growing region because the housing cost differential is insurmountable. So they stay put, their skills atrophy or go underutilized, and the economy as a whole loses the productivity gains that would come from better matching.
This is the Rust Belt trap you mentioned with Youngstown.
It's not just the Rust Belt. It's rural areas across the country. It's smaller cities that have lost their industrial base. The people in these places aren't lazy or unskilled. They're geographically mismatched. And the data from Chetty's team shows that moving to a high-opportunity metro area, Seattle, Minneapolis, Boston, San Francisco, has a larger measurable effect on a child's future earnings than almost any individual policy intervention that's been studied.
That's a huge claim. What's the evidence?
There was a landmark experiment called Moving to Opportunity, run by HUD in the 1990s. They took low-income families living in high-poverty neighborhoods and randomly assigned some of them to receive housing vouchers that could only be used in low-poverty neighborhoods. The control group stayed where they were. The initial results were disappointing. They looked at the adults and didn't see much change in earnings. But then Chetty's team reanalyzed the data and looked at the children. The children who moved to low-poverty neighborhoods before age 13 had a 31% increase in annual earnings as adults. That's about $3,500 a year in 2014 dollars, which compounds over a career into hundreds of thousands of dollars in lifetime earnings.
The intervention worked. It just worked on the kids, not the parents, and it took 20 years to show up in the data.
Which is a profound insight about mobility. The effects of place compound over time, and they compound most powerfully during childhood. Where you grow up isn't just a backdrop, it's an active input into your future earnings. And that's true at a hyperlocal level. Chetty's team has produced maps, the Opportunity Atlas, that show expected earnings for children raised in every census tract in America. The variation within cities is enormous. Two children growing up in census tracts 2 miles apart in the same city can have radically different expected outcomes based on nothing more than which side of an invisible line they lived on.
Which brings us back to the birth lottery. Your parents didn't just give you genes and values. They gave you a set of GPS coordinates.
Those coordinates are increasingly determinative. Let me give you one more mechanism that connects all of this. It's what some researchers call assortative mating. High-earning people increasingly marry other high-earning people. In 1970, if you looked at a high-earning man, his wife was likely not in the labor force or earned modestly. Today, high-earning men tend to marry high-earning women. so you have two high incomes pooling in one household, which concentrates advantage even further. The gap between what a dual-income professional household can invest in their children, in housing, in education, in enrichment, and what a single parent or dual low-income household can invest has widened dramatically.
The family structure amplifies the income distribution. The rich couple doesn't just have twice the income. They have more than twice the capacity to invest in their kids because they can pool resources and specialize.
That's before we even get to the social capital dimension. High-income parents are more likely to have networks that include other high-income professionals, people who can provide internships, job referrals, mentorship. These networks are often invisible to the people inside them. You don't think of calling your college roommate who now works at a venture capital firm as deploying social capital. You think of it as catching up with an old friend. But it is social capital, and it's enormously valuable.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure I follow the analogy, but I'll trust you on it.
You think you're just being nice, but you've actually acquired an asset that hunts for you.
That is a deeply corn way of putting it, and I'm going to move on before I think about it too hard. Let me pull together the threads on what the opposite of upward mobility looks like in practice. It's not a single dramatic fall. It's a set of conditions that compound. You're born into a low opportunity census tract. Your schools are funded by low property taxes. The networks around you don't include people who can open doors to high-paying professions. College is theoretically available but practically risky. The wrong choice leaves you with debt and no premium. The high-opportunity metro areas are priced out of your reach. You work hard, maybe harder than your parents did, but the basket of goods that defines a middle-class life costs 3 times what it did relative to your earnings. You're not destitute. You're not homeless. You're just stuck.
The stuckness is the point. The American dream promised motion. What we're describing is stasis dressed up as normal life.
Here's the uncomfortable question that the data forces us to confront. If absolute mobility, the straightforward, my kids will do better than me version of the American dream, is empirically dead for anyone born after 1970, what replaces it? What's the social narrative that holds a society together when the promise of generational progress can no longer be delivered to a majority of the population?
That's the question that keeps political strategists up at night. Because the American dream wasn't just a nice idea, it was a social stabilizer. It told people that the system was fair and that patience would be rewarded. If you take that away, you don't just get economic discontent. You get a legitimacy crisis.
You can see it in the polling data. Trust in institutions has collapsed over the same period that absolute mobility has collapsed. Correlation isn't causation, but the timing is suggestive. When people stop believing the system delivers, they stop believing in the system.
What actually works? We've spent a lot of time on the problem. What does the data say about solutions?
This is where the research gets surprisingly practical. The single most powerful intervention, based on the Chetty data, is geographic mobility. Moving a low-income family with young children to a high-opportunity neighborhood produces measurable, statistically significant increases in those children's lifetime earnings. The Moving to Opportunity experiment showed a 31% earnings bump for kids who moved before age 13. That's not a small effect, that's transformational.
The policy implication is housing vouchers targeted at families with young children, with requirements that they be used in low-poverty neighborhoods.
And some cities are already experimenting with this. Seattle has a program that gives housing vouchers to low-income families specifically to move into high-opportunity neighborhoods with good schools. The early results are promising, but scaling this is politically difficult because it means challenging local zoning laws, which are the primary mechanism by which high-income communities exclude low-income families.
Zoning is the velvet rope.
That's exactly what it is. Single-family zoning, minimum lot sizes, parking requirements. These all function as exclusionary barriers that keep housing supply low and prices high in the neighborhoods with the best schools and the best opportunity sets. And they're defended fiercely by the people who already live there, often with rhetoric about neighborhood character and local control that sounds reasonable but functions as a gatekeeping mechanism.
Covering the covers.
The other intervention that the data supports is investing in place-based improvements, making low-opportunity areas better rather than moving people out of them, but the evidence here is weaker. Place-based interventions tend to show smaller effects, and they take much longer to materialize. The most effective approach seems to be a combination. Improve the worst-off neighborhoods while also giving families the option to move to better ones.
On the education front?
The data on education is more nuanced than the public debate suggests. Simply increasing school spending doesn't reliably improve mobility outcomes. It matters how the money is spent. What does seem to matter is teacher quality, especially in early grades. Chetty has a separate line of research showing that students assigned to high-value added teachers in elementary school have significantly higher earnings as adults. But the effect is modest compared to the geographic mobility effect. A great teacher adds maybe 1-2% to lifetime earnings. Moving to a high-opportunity neighborhood adds 31%.
If you have to choose between fixing the schools in a poor neighborhood and helping families leave that neighborhood, the data says help them leave.
The data says both, but if you have limited resources and want maximum impact, the mobility intervention is hard to beat. And that's an uncomfortable finding for a lot of people because it feels like giving up on places. But the evidence is what it is.
Let me pull us toward a conclusion. We started with the 90-50 collapse in absolute mobility. We walked through the mechanisms. The distribution of growth, the Great Gatsby curve, opportunity hoarding, the housing school linkage, the decline in geographic mobility, the erosion of the college premium. We describe what downward mobility looks like in practice, not destitution, but structural stuckness. And we identified one intervention that the data says actually works. What should a listener take away from all of this?
I think there are three actionable takeaways. First, if you're making a personal decision about where to raise your kids, the data says that the neighborhood you choose, specifically its poverty rate, school quality, and social capital density, is one of the largest single inputs into your children's future earnings. It matters more than almost any school choice within that neighborhood. Second, if you're thinking about policy, the most cost-effective intervention we have evidence for is housing vouchers that enable low-income families with young children to move to high-opportunity areas. Third, the college decision needs to be made with clear eyes about return on investment. Not all degrees are created equal, and the wrong choice can leave you worse off.
The bigger picture takeaway, the one that's harder to sit with, is that the American dream, as most people understand it, was a specific historical phenomenon, not a permanent feature of the American economy. It was enabled by a particular distribution of growth that no longer exists. Recreating it isn't just a matter of faster GDP growth. It requires a different distribution of whatever growth we do achieve.
Which is a fundamentally political question, not a technical one. The economics tells us what's happening and what interventions work, but whether we choose to implement those interventions is a question about values and power.
That's where we'll pick up next time. We're going to look at one proposed alternative, the Nordic model of social mobility, and ask whether it's exportable to the United States, or whether the cultural and institutional differences make it a non-starter.
I'm looking forward to that one. The Denmark comparison alone is worth an entire episode.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, a notary on Réunion Island preserved legal documents by sandwiching them between sheets of banana leaf coated in aloe vera pulp, a technique that rendered the paper both insect repellent and surprisingly supple. One such document, an 1843 property deed, was discovered in 2019, still perfectly legible, and described by the archivist who found it as feeling, quote, like a freshly ironed shirt.
Right. This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. You can also find us at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll see you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's
wash the clothes from slop, from man, from long ear hose. My windbombs, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.